whenever I was a kid, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a rough age, maybe 7 or 8, but whenever I was younger, I remember having this experience that happened a lot as a child that honestly I expected to go away and it kind of never did growing up. But I remember vividly being about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, waking up in the middle of the night and seeing across from my bedroom, again, being disoriented, maybe like groggy, wiping my face, and still seeing something, a figure of something. I couldn't figure out what it was. It looked lifelike. It looked maybe like a human, but then all of a sudden it looked like horns. And I remember even as a kid being like, even with a vivid imagination, be like, nah, that's not what I'm seeing. Like, clearly, this can't be that. But even with the logic side of my brain really trying to push through, I kept looking and kept seeing the silhouette in the darkness. I'd be like, I don't know what it is. So I remember sneaking across the room, turning on the light, and it was just like dirty clothes stacked on my, you know, I don't know, chair. And it was like, I knew cognitively this ain't what it looks like, but I couldn't shake the feeling that there was something in the room. And I remember having that experience a lot. And even as an adult, once or twice, being like, okay, the logical side's gonna kick through, and I'm gonna sit there, I'm gonna look at it until I figure out what it is. And then just be like, nah, it looks creepy. So I turn on the light, I'm like, okay, I knew it wasn't what it was, but that is what it is. So that's one picture of what I'm trying to catch here. The other one is a more silly one, even though that one's pretty silly. But the congregation I moved here from in Oklahoma is a really beautiful building. It's over 100 years old, and it's kind of made to look like an old, I don't know, courthouse or something. So externally and within the sanctuary auditorium, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's something that people around the community love. But, you know, being there quite a bit, I'm like, I don't know, it is old, man. Like, all the, I know, you know, being in the elders meetings and whatnot, I know all the repairs. Like it is a mess. And then, if nothing else, the downstairs was infamous amongst kids because it was creepy. If you were downstairs at night, it was like, I mean, it was haunted. We all knew it. Even the logical adults knew it's haunted. I think we have one for not PTP. Oh, we just went Lads to Leaders, a puppet room. And you go downstairs and you come upon the puppet room at night, it is terrifying, just terrifying. What I'm trying to describe is a specific sensation, and maybe that's what we're doing tonight. Tonight we're doing a little bit of an experiment, or at least an exercise. I invite you to go over to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, but as you turn over there, we're not going to be doing a whole lot of reading. We're just mainly using it as a light resource, because what we're doing tonight is trying to catch a feeling that we are not alone, that there is something out there, that this feeling, this sensation, this understanding that we are not alone is something that many throughout history have felt at various times. It is often unsettling. It's often perhaps a tad menacing. That's why, you know, folklore and ghost stories are perhaps grown over history. But I think no matter the year, the decade, the generation, the continent, nation upon nation, culture upon culture has come to this understanding. We are not alone. And it's something that I think is very important for us to feel, to sense, and to sit in for a moment to understand the severity of what's going on. The book of Acts, again, we're going to use this as a light example. We're going to use tonight as a kickoff for something of trying to feel something. And right now we're going to be talking about those who perhaps have never heard of God. Those who have never read a Bible, heard a sermon, or heard the term Yahweh before. And what can they experience? In Acts chapter 17, Paul comes to Athens, a great city of paganism and heathenism. And in chapter 17, verse 18, he identifies two big groups of perhaps polar opposites in the religious world. One are the Epicureans, and they are often associated with the gaiety of life and purpose. Like, it's kind of the idea of maybe they consider divine beings slightly, but if so, it's the gods of food, nourishment, and sex. Life and otherworldliness and all of its reverence is nice and all, but it's kind of like, hey, drink up, me hearties. for today or tomorrow shall end. On the other side, you have the Stoics. The Stoics, again, not being an expert in the field, what I understand about the Stoics are they are, you know, that's where Stoicism comes from. They're very serious, pragmatic, practical people. Individuals who sense something at work in this world, but kind of ultimately still fall short because they keep leaning on wisdom and logic and philosophy and reason to kind of work their way through it. And again, if nothing else, we're going to use these two groups as like a nice balance of how people grapple with the experience that we are not alone. Some lightheartedly say, hey, today is here, tomorrow is gone. Others take it seriously and severely and with the proper honor and respect, but to what purpose? Because the question is, what's out there? If there is something, then what? If it is someone, then who? What? It's kind of a, what's in the darkness? What do you sense? Who is this that breathes from the deep? What lurks out there? Whether it be Rome, whether it be Greece, whether it be Egypt, Babylon, or some like, I don't know, forgotten cult in the hills that we'll never know about. Everyone has had, and every religion and every people and species has had this experience that there is something under the world. They sense it, we sense it, they felt it, and we have felt it likewise. Something is at work. The pagan, the remote one, going about their day in Athens, came to experience this. And for this man, this peculiar straggler from the East, Paul, he identifies it as an unknown God. And he says, you felt it. You know something else is there. And you have religions, you have philosophies, you have behaviors in life to grapple with whatever it is, but all of them keep leaving you empty. So let me tell you about that something, about that entity, about that thing in the darkness that you sense, that you experience, that you fear, and that you know to be there. First off, Paul identifies this. Whatever it is, it creates. It is a creator of things you couldn't even imagine. It creates so many things. In fact, so this is something that I think we can appreciate within our congregation is that we have a congregation full of people who have gone abroad, who have gone and experienced other cultures and other nations. I think that that's awesome. Our preacher's over there in Albania right now. So like we are a congregation who likes to send and go. And I've asked some people who've gone because I've been able to go overseas a handful of times. But some individuals who just love being other in nations, whether it's Europe or Asia, I've asked them what they like it. And one of the reasons that they've circled back to is you don't realize how young of a nation in a history America seems to have. But that's not to take like shots at our UT, you know, legacy here. It's a vibrant history, but there's something about going to another land where their history is far more ancient, where you sense empires and you sense history upon the very ground and the very dirt you happen to walk on. And I think that that's a fascinating recollection, one that I never really registered with whenever I got to go overseas. But that there is something ancient in history, but even within empires and empires, underneath, there is something even older, something at work that's even grander. This thing does not live in temples made by hands. This thing does not need you and I, but it creates. And I think that it's fair to say you and I create. We try to create. We are humans. We like creation, and we like to be a part of it and engaged with it. And that's awesome. We've created some really stunning things. For Paul, he stood there. He was in the Areopagus, a very important, significant place where they had philosophical debates or hearings or judicial hearings, rather. So there's a lot of stuff at work going on, and he's surrounded by kind of a lot of religious history and significance. But one of the places specifically is what is described as the Parthenon. And I always I'm careful about that because Tennessee has their own Parthenon. It's in Nashville. But here's a couple of informations or a couple of tidbits about that. The Parthenon in Athens was carved out of marble, and it took the Greeks approximately 10 years to build this incredible thing. Now I'm going to go through some of the archaeological, architectural cool things about it. That again, I'm just a non-architectural dude. I didn't really follow, so I had to find a dumbed-down version of it. But for reference, Nashville, even with modern everything in the 20s through 30s, still took 10 years. So I think that that's interesting for what it's worth. But here's interesting things about the Parthenon, a place that would have been right to the side of Mars Hill. It has all horizontal architectural elements, or all the elements arch slightly to the center. This means that there are no true straight horizontal lines in the Parthenon. All the external columns incline slightly inward. And here's what I'm saying. In short, no matter where you look at it, the structure creates the illusion that the columns and the ceilings look pristinely level at all times. As one guy on YouTube put it, here's a good summary. They were creating solutions to problems that no one had ever thought of. Humanity's done some pretty cool things, has created some really stunning artifacts. But whatever else is out there that those in Athens on that day came to understand, it creates far more than what you and I are capable of doing, what our ancestors upon ancestors have been capable of doing. This thing creates. There's a German philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant, and he described something that stood with me. A friend of mine who's good at philosophy shared this. I'm not really. I was trying to describe a feeling, and he described this as dynamically sublime. And I'll tell you what dynamically sublime means. It means witnessing something that makes you feel small and the world catastrophically big. For Immanuel Kant, for him, it was like these things tend to point you to something divine out there. A volcano erupting, a tornado coming from Oklahoma, right in your backyard, makes you feel pretty small. Rain from the heavens, lightning striking. I'll tell you the one thing that I've used multiple times, so if any of the youth group kids may have heard this one already, I apologize. But one of my favorite memories that Crystal and I will always hold to is 2020, we got a really cheap hotel stay right on the beach in Florida that was Destin. And we were like, man, this is so cheap. We went with our family. This was great. We had never got a better offer. And we didn't realize the Westerners that we were. It's hurricane season. No one's going down there. Truly catastrophic for your hopes for having a nice family vacation. Turn off the electricity for a full 24 hours at least. Here's the thing though. Pretty rough trip. But I will never forget being at the sands, looking out, and seeing a hurricane coming our way. I never felt smaller in my life. And what's interesting about the dynamically sublime experience is you realize there's something huge out there. And it terrifies, but it gives you pleasure. It makes no sense. I've never been more giddy in my life. And then all of a sudden, the sand really started to hit my bare feet. And I was like, oh, we got to go. So we got out of there really quickly. There are experiences that we have in humanity that makes us reflect on how huge the world, how huge the elements are, how small, simple, fragile we are. There's something out there. And it creates. It presents. But not only that, the elements, I think, show something else. It guides. This thing, whatever it is, this entity, this creature, this being, it's something that guides. It's something that has a determined path and strategy for humanity. This ancient presence that moves, this breath in your midst, part of why it cleans and breathes and can be felt is because there's an unavoidable order to the way of the cosmos, is there not? Science, biology, nature, all of it adds up to something that just works. It's something unavoidable. It's something concrete and ever-present. But it's not only in mineral or gravitational pull, it's also in relationship. Like, there is a way to treat the people you love so that it is both fruitful and successful for you collectively and you individually. And humanity's really good at, like, messing up science, biology, relationships. We sometimes maybe don't even acknowledge that there is, like, a determined path, that there is a way of the cosmos, that there is some order to all of this. But still, whether we see it, sense it, experience it in our day-to-day life, whenever we break it, we sure experience it. But still, it's ever-present. That there is just a way and there is a path that makes sense in this world, that's ever moving, that's ever going. And that's pretty cool. This breath has done all of this with eternity and existence and time. And by itself, if this theme, this, we're gonna be crass here, this creature far off, if all it did was create and be all powerful and all knowledgeable by creating a path for us that was efficient for us, and it went away and, seeped away into the darkness again, never to see, just to watch, that would be enough. Like, it can do what it wants. But whatever it is doesn't really stop there, does it? In fact, the ancients understood something else that it also purposes within our life. It has a way about it, and it's given that way to us. It's given that something to us. The pagan senses, as all man has done through all of humanity, a presence and a pull towards our being, towards our meaning, towards our significance. Or worse, there's a crisis whenever we feel like we don't have one. But this thing definitely has an eternal consciousness in mind. Do we just live and exist for nothing? That's the question. There's a thought of nihilism that was popular forever ago and is popular now. What if nothing mattered? Could we live? Could we be satisfied? Would it be enough? So another philosopher by the name of Soren Kierkegaard, and you have his quote there. He says, if there was no eternal consciousness in a man, if the foundation of all there lay only a wildly seething power which writhing with obscure passions produced everything that is great and everything that is insignificant, if a bottomless void never satiated lay hidden beneath all, what then would life be but despair? That's a lot of jargon, dare I say. But the point I think you can get in that last leg, if nothing mattered, what would we have but to live here in our despair? Some people, Soren would say, would like, you know, they would find solace in just entertaining themselves to death. Like, let's have fun. Like the Epicureans, let's have the best party we ever had. You know, tomorrow we die, so let's live it up. But William Lane Craig, an apologetic man, he put it this way. He says, yet he, Kierkegaard, acknowledges that pleasure in the face of nothingness would lead to unhappiness, to no true satisfaction, and finally to boredom, a sort of sickness with life. So whatever this thing is that has created and has ordered has also given us something to do with our time and something to live for. We're going to read this text, chapter 17, verse 27. It says that you and I should seek God, perhaps feel their way towards him, and lastly find him. Yeah, he is actually not far from each one of us. I think that's pretty cool. Let's break this down just slightly here. The phrase for seek him is to desire something that has been lost, to be able to be on a search, to yearn for something that's out there. The phrase feel, some of your translations might say grope for. And this is interesting. That's a term to just kind of show like how important it is, but also kind of how intimate it is. The phrase for touched or grope is the same, is only used four times in the New Testament, and one of the times is for when Thomas, who doubted, went to touch Jesus because he was yearning for some sort of purpose in this life. And lastly, to find him, but we're going to sit on that one and come back to that for our conclusion. So whatever this is out there, this man Paul knew and stressed that life had to be lived for more than just now, than more than just entertaining ourselves, and definitely more than nothing at all. This is something that is out there, and he's not far from us, whoever he may be. Next, it embraces. And I think that this is a pretty interesting thought here. I heard this, I read this in a book, and I know Travis has actually gone through this, so I really appreciate that. So if I'm a little repetitive, that's That's okay. I can be repetitive. But here's something that I thought was interesting. N.T. Wright is an author and a teacher, and he talks about four myths that reveal that there's something more out there in the cosmos, that tell our souls that, like, something's there. One of them is a desire for justice, that every human group and individual knows that there should be a right and wrong. Whether we disagree on what that is, totally valid, we understand that there should be justice. Every creature, and I know that modernity has really tried to, like, I don't know, step on this, but there's a spiritual calling to all nations everywhere, man. Like, there is something pulling at their heartstrings towards a spiritual calling that gets them past just the physical here and now. The beauty of the creation. Who amongst us has not appreciated that in our landscape, in our backyards? But this fourth one is kind of what I'm wanting to look to here. It gives us relationship. It embraces us with this relationship. The pagans' own poets, they say this, "In him we live and move and have our being." As even some of your own poets have said, those who were of that time, "For we are indeed his offspring." Now for them, this was written by an individual by the name of Artus of Soli, and it was in reference to Zeus. But this man, Paul, here amongst the Areopagus, is saying this is about truly something else far greater. And not only does it create an order, not only does it, you know, give us purpose, something to busy our hands with, but it embraces us and makes us its child. How critical and beautiful is that? That this is something that those who were there understood was a yearning of their heart, that all of us wish to belong and wish to be part of something, but specifically part of something that is affectionately love. How incredible is it that this thing is now pursuing us and has wished the best for us? It beckons us. Speaking of N.T. Wright and those myths, this is what I think is interesting. All these things show, all those myths that we referred to, I'll go back briefly, the desire for justice, the spiritual calling, the beauty of earth, the existence of relationships, they all show us that there's something out there more than just like the here and now. That's cool. But do you know what they all are? They're myths. They're little teases. Because there's a desire for justice is because there's a breaking of justice. Because there's a spiritual calling, it's because we live in the here and now, and it's kind of icky. There's beauty on the earth, but man, have we seen decaying corruption. There's existence of relationships, but man, is there tearing apart of relationships. For every pro, there is a negative. But this thing beckons us forward because that's not the way it wishes us to live. In fact, there is an invitation to repent because we have actively been involved with the evil and corruption of this world that show to us that there should be something better than what we're doing now. It invites us to know it and to overlook not like ignorance anymore, but this thing invites you and I to a better way and a better in existence. To not just live with the judgment that perhaps is to come for these people, but rather to live for the life that it offers here and now. And lastly, who is it? What is it? You can't have this conversation anymore if you don't acknowledge that what this unknown God is, peering from the darkness, walking forward from the fog in very theatrical setting, it's a man carrying a cross. It is he who was revealed to be God himself as a man, by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. And I think we all affirm this truth, I think and hope and I pray. But I think that this is worth pausing to understand that God calls to all. That God has invited all from the beginning of time to see and to experience that there is a better way, that there is a better caretaker, that there is a better path. And now, for the ancient first century world, they revealed it singularly in the man, Jesus Christ. That it is found only in he and he alone. So what is he? Who is he? Out of the ominous, overwhelming fear is not someone who's to be feared, but rather someone who is wonderful, who is mighty, who is generous, who's creative, who's brilliant, who's impossible, who is everything, who is now defined by love and wants to be known as such. It's pretty cool. It's a pretty neat story of how God connects to humanity, no matter how far they are, no matter what dark world they live in. And so he gives us a purpose. I told you I'd come back to this and circle back to this. But in verse 27, Paul says that there is something that he calls us to. And I think it does act as like the singular part of the lesson. He says they would seek him, they would reach and touch for him, grope for him, and that they would find him. And the word for find is cool because in the book of Acts, it's used quite a bit. It's not exactly one that's used like significantly. It could be as much as like going to find, you know, a person who works in a certain industry. It could be going to find your family member. But it's used throughout Acts, and Acts is cool because it is like, man, it is the story of the journey of the church. It is the story about God's people being created and made ultimately into the people who were directed by his Spirit for the very first time as a collective group. And now they go. And they get to be people who demonstrate what it means to go and to find. To find and to experience God because he's not far from us. The book of Acts is about how God is there reaching into your and my lives to show us who he is, to reveal to us who he is. That time of ignorance might be gone. So what can we do with this information? Perhaps it's as simple as you know that you can present this information to someone who has not found him yourself. To understand that there are many who are seeking, whether they identify it or not. Many in this story don't. They actually mock Paul, but others are willing to hear a little bit more. So pray for those who are willing to hear a little bit more. Present this information in a way as Paul did, tactfully and in the world around them, understanding that all of us have universal experiences, that we know that there is something more, something that creates, something that directs, something that beckons us, something that gives us purpose, and something that loves us. And that is Jesus Christ, our King, and his Father, and his God. And here's a nice little quote that I think acts as a nice summary. So all of this is about finding him. Here's a quote from John B. Polhill. It says, "There's no question about God's purpose for yours and my life. God did create humans to seek him. This is the proper response of the creature. The responsibility of humanity is to seek, to behold, to worship their God." So let us stand and worship at this time. And if there's any need you have, please come forward together as we stand and as we sing.